This week, we're going to spend an hour on a phrase that has become impossible to argue with: iLiteracy. And before we start, here's the thing that keeps nagging at me. When someone tells you a skill is the new literacy, they've already won the argument. Nobody is against literacy. Nobody wants their grandmother left out of the modern world. So the word arrives, pre-approved, wrapped in the moral authority of the alphabet itself. But when I actually read a year of writing about iLiteracy and ask what it's meant to protect, the answer keeps coming back the same: a resume, your future employability, your country's competitiveness, your company's compliance posture. And meanwhile, there is a woman answering the phone at 9 at night, and the voice on the line is sobbing in her son's exact timbre, asking her to wire money. And I cannot find the curriculum that was written for her. That's the gap I want us to sit inside today. You're listening to Tertulia, the I Conversation, slowed down. This week we're talking about iFraud literacy for vulnerable citizens, the elderly, the isolated, children, anyone the deception is specifically engineered to reach. Not the literacy that makes you a better user of these tools. The other one, the literacy that would teach a person to distrust the voice on the phone. Our written edition made an argument this week that I want to test at this table, that the whole year of A-literacy talk built a skill for users and left the targets to fend for themselves. Four of us are here to argue about whether that's fair. Let me start by putting everyone in the room, and I'll do it the way we always do, not by what's on your card, but by what you've actually been chewing on lately. Let me start with you.
I've been reading across a strange pile of things: gerontology journals, fraud prevention pamphlets that banks mail out, and then the glossy A-literacy frameworks. And what struck me is that they don't seem to know about each other. The bank pamphlet is all defense: hang up, call back, don't trust, urgency. The A-literacy framework is all offense: learn to prompt, learn to build, learn to comprehend. They're using the same word, literacy, and they're describing two different animals. I came in thinking they'd converge somewhere. They don't.
And you?
I've been running voice cloning tools, not to be alarming, to see where the floor is now. And the floor has dropped through the basement. A year ago, you needed maybe a minute of clean audio and some technical patience. Now I can take 3 seconds off a voicemail greeting and produce something that will fool the person who gave birth to that voice. What I keep thinking about is that the defense advice we give, listen for the robotic cadence, listen for the flat effect, is advice for a generation of the technology that is already dead. We're teaching people to spot seams that no longer exist.
That's a chilling place to start. Hold that, because I want to come back to it. And you?
I've been thinking about how old this pattern is. Every communication technology in the last century arrives with a literacy panic and a literacy promise, and the promise is almost always framed around production, around competence, around joining the modern economy. The threat model is always falling behind. It is almost never being preyed upon. There's a line in one of the ethics volumes I keep returning to: the observation that our theories of privacy and exploitation quietly assume the user is an autonomous, healthy, relatively young adult with full mental capacities. That assumption is the whole problem in one sentence. Build your literacy for that person, and you have built it for the person least likely to be defrauded.
We'll unpack that assumption, because I think it's load-bearing for the whole hour. And finally,
I keep asking the question I always ask, which is, who bears the cost? And what's clarifying about this topic is that the answer is unusually precise. The cost of the productive literacy, the one that teaches you to use the tools, falls on everyone a little, and it pays off for the people who already have a roster around them: students, employees, constituents. The cost of the defensive gap falls almost entirely on one population, and it's the population defined by not being on any roster: the retired, the homebound, the socially isolated. Nobody is enrolled in being old and alone and alone. So there's no delivery mechanism to reach them, and the harm concentrates exactly where the reach is thinnest.
So let me lay out the phenomenon plainly, because I think our listeners have read the headlines: the voice cloning scams, the familiar in distress calls, the deep faked official. But I'm not sure they've seen the shape underneath. Let me try, and any of you jump in when I get it wrong. The claim from our written edition this week is that there are two lines that ought to be the same line, and they aren't. Line one is the rhetoric of iLiteracy, which swelled all through last year, confident and expansive. Line two is the reality of who actually gets reached, by what program, against which threat. And the argument is that where those lines meet, there's a real consensus. Everyone agrees people should understand these systems. But where they miss on the most important thing, which is the definition of the word. Is that a fair setup?
It's fair, but I'd sharpen one thing. It's not just that the lines miss, it's that the productive line actively crowds out the defensive one. When a program teaches a senior to leverage A, to use it as a helper, a companion, a tool, it is building a habit of trust in exactly the kind of system that the scam then exploits. You're being trained to feel comfortable with a synthetic voice being helpful. And then a synthetic voice calls and asks for money. The comfort and the vulnerability are produced by the same lesson.
I want to be careful there, because I mostly agree, but I think that framing can tip into something I don't believe, which is that we should teach people to fear the technology wholesale. That's not defensible and it's not livable. My mother uses a voice assistant to set timers, and it's genuinely good for her. The issue isn't trust in the tool, it's trust in the channel. The lesson we failed to teach is that the channel, a phone call, a video, a voice, is no longer evidence of identity. That's the specific thing that broke, and it's a narrow enough thing that you could actually teach it.
Say more about channel versus tool, because I think that distinction might be the whole episode.
For most of human history, a voice was a credential. If you heard your son's voice, it was your son. That was a reliable inference for 100,000 years. What generative audio did is sever the link between the voice and the person, silently, without most people being told the link was severed. So the defensive literacy isn't fear of A. It's a single updated inference. The voice proves nothing now, the face proves nothing now. Verify through a channel the attacker doesn't control. Call back on a number you already had. That's it. That's the lesson. And it's almost never in the curriculum because the curriculum is busy teaching you to prompt.
This is where I'd bring in the older idea about the medium. There's a tradition of thought that says every medium reshapes what we take as real before we've noticed. The telephone made the disembodied voice intimate. That was the whole social revolution of it, that a voice from far away felt like presence. And now the same intimacy the medium manufactured is the attack surface. The scam doesn't work despite the phone feeling personal. It works because the phone was designed, over a century, to make a voice feel like a person in the room.
And notice who invested in that century of intimacy. The phone company had every incentive to make you feel your loved one was present. Nobody had an incentive to remind you it was a representation. That's not a conspiracy, it's just where the incentives pointed. And I'd argue the iLiteracy discourse tilts the same way for the same reason. A literacy defined as productive fluency serves the people selling the tools. It manufactures capable customers. A literacy defined as defensive suspicion serves only the person, and sometimes it serves them by teaching distrust of the very product the first literacy is selling. So, of course, the discourse tilted toward fluency. The incentive chose its object. Its
That's the sharpest version of the thesis, and I want to flag it, so we can test it later, because I'm not fully sure I buy the incentive story. It might be simpler than that. It might just be that institutions can only teach the people they can reach. But let's hold it. Let me zoom out for a second and ask the naive question our listener is asking. Why now? Voice cloning has been around. Phishing is old. What made this a civic imperative this particular week?
The cost curve. It used to be that a convincing impersonation was expensive. Expensive in audio, in expertise, in time. So attackers reserved it for high-value targets. What changed is that it became nearly free and nearly instant. When the cost of a bespoke, personalized, emotionally precise attack drops to almost zero, you don't just get more attacks. You get a change in who gets targeted. It's now economical to run the grandmother scam against every grandmother, individually, with each one's actual grandchild's voice. That's the shift. Personalized fraud at industrial scale.
Right. And I'd add the data supply chain, because the voice has to come from somewhere. There's a general observation about these systems that I think about constantly, that people often don't even know data is being gathered, or that data they gave in one context gets used by a third party in a completely different one. That's the scam supply chain stated in the abstract. The voice clip came from a video posted to celebrate a graduation. The photo came from a birthday. The contact list leaked in a breach 3 years ago. None of it was gathered to defraud anyone. It just sits there, harvestable, and the generative layer recombines it into a plausible emergency.
And this is the part the empowerment literature genuinely cannot see, because it's looking the other way. The same generative capability that a financial literacy pilot in Bihar uses to teach the unbanked is the capability that clones a voice to steal from them. They aren't cousins. They're the same tool pointed in two directions, and only one direction got a curriculum.
Let me make sure our listener has the human picture and not just the abstraction. Give me the scene. What does the attack actually look like at the kitchen table?
It's 9 at night. The phone rings. The voice is her grandson, and he's crying, and he says he's been in an accident, or he's been arrested, and there's a lawyer, and it has to be cash or a transfer right now. And please don't tell mom. Every element of that is engineered. The hour, because defenses are down and there's nobody to consult. The crying, because distress suppresses scrutiny. The secrecy, because it isolates her from the second channel that would save her. The urgency, because urgency is the whole mechanism. It collapses the time in which she might think. And the voice, which is now perfect. So the thing I want people to hear is that this is not an attack on her competence. She could be a retired engineer. It's an attack on her love. And you cannot patch love with a tutorial on how to prompt a chatbot.
That last line is exactly why I think the two literacies are non-substitutable. You could make her the most fluent A user in her retirement community, and she'd still wire the money because the fluency addresses the wrong faculty. The scam roots around the analytical brain entirely. It goes straight for attachment.
So if that's the phenomenon, and I think we've drawn it clearly, the question for the rest of the hour is whether the year of A literacy talk was, as our written edition charges, essentially a literacy for users and not for targets, and whether that's an indictment or just an honest limit of what institutions can do. Let's trace how the discourse actually moved, because I think the chronology matters. Take me back through the year. Where did the conversation start and how did it travel? I want the arc, because our written edition claims the arc barely moved. Optimism led every quarter and never inverted. Is that how you all remember it?
Early in the year, the register was economic and it was confident. The flagship documents framed A capability as a national maturity journey. Literacy was a thing, a workforce accumulated so an economy could climb. There was a blueprint for intelligent economies that treated the whole matter as regional competitiveness. There was a framework for the Global South with the tagline about moving from margins to momentum. Literacy as the ticket off the sidelines of the digital revolution. Even the scholarly work carried it. There was a study of information science students across Bangladesh, India, and Pakistan. 632 respondents, and literacy there meant professional readiness. Every one of these has the same threat model. The threat is falling behind. The victim, if there is one, is a country.
And in none of that does the word protect against deception.
Not once. In that early material, there was a program that opened by defining literacy the old way. The ability to read, write, speak, listen, use numeracy and technology, and then extended the analogy to I. It's a generous definition and a revealing one because it describes a person who produces and comprehends. It never once describes a person who is targeted. The literate subject is a competent user, and the entire moral force of the word is bent toward getting more people to that competence.
I'd push on the chronology a little, because I don't remember it as flat. I remember the aperture widening in the second quarter. It went from workforce to everyone. There was a piece declaring, understanding no longer a luxury reserved for tech professionals. And by mid-year, it had hardened from an opportunity into an obligation. The pieces titled things like Why iLiteracy is Becoming a Must. So there was movement. It just wasn't movement toward defense. It was movement toward universality. More people, same definition.
That's fair, and I'll accept the correction. It's not that the arc was static. It's that it expanded on one axis, reach, while staying frozen on the other axis, which is what literacy is for. I was collapsing those.
Here's where I think a real disagreement might live, and I want to draw it out rather than smooth it over. Our written edition treats the second quarter, when critical framings nearly matched the optimistic ones, 18 to 17, as a genuine contest that resolved into nothing. But you two seem to read that near parity differently.
I read it as a mirage, and I'll say why. When you actually read the critical framings from that quarter, they're arguing about hype, about labor displacement, about ethics in the abstract. They are not arguing about the specific machinery of fraud aimed at specific vulnerable people. So the count says there was a debate, but the debate was optimism about jobs versus pessimism about jobs. It was never optimism about empowerment versus a defensive, victim-centered account. That account wasn't even on the field. You can't invert an arc against a rival that was never assembled to compete.
See, I don't fully agree, and I think this is a real difference between us. I think the critical strand, even when it was talking about misinformation and manipulation in the abstract, was reaching toward the same danger. It just stayed at the level of democracy and never came down to the kitchen table. There was a piece from early in the year, The Battle for Truth Won, that put manipulation of what we read and watch and believe at the center. And the UNESCO thread carries it too, invoking the old Cambridge Analytica case to show how curation and content moderation can bend democratic systems. So the concern about deception was present. My disagreement with you is that I don't think it was absent. I think it was misfiled. It got filed under democracy when it also belonged under the individual person's front door.
And that's the tell, isn't it? That the manipulation of belief registered as a democratic problem and only faintly as a personal one. Why would that be?
Because democratic harm has a constituency. There are institutions, scholars, journalists, whose job is to worry about the integrity of the public sphere. The lonely woman at 9 at night has no constituency. So the same underlying phenomenon gets the attention that its constituency can command, on hers commands none. That's my version, and I think it's slightly different from yours. You're saying the defensive account was never built. I'm saying it was built, but only at the scale that has advocates. And it never got scaled down to the individual because the individual is politically invisible.
I can live with that as a difference. You think it existed in a form that couldn't reach the target. I think it barely existed at all in the relevant form. Those are genuinely different claims, and I don't think we're going to resolve, which is right, because it partly depends on how generous you are about counting a democracy-level concern as a proto-version of a personal one.
Let's leave that unresolved on the table, because I think both of you are pointing at something true, and the tension between them is more useful than a forced agreement. Let me bring in the technical arc, because there's a parallel line I want traced. What was actually happening to the capability while the discourse was doing all this?
The capability was doing the opposite of what the discourse assumed. The discourse assumed literacy meant catching up to a static thing, but the thing wasn't static. The deceptive capability was accelerating faster than any curriculum could be written, tested, and deployed. Think about the pipeline. You identify a threat. You design a lesson. You validate it. You find a delivery route. You actually teach the population. That's a multi-year process at best. And in that same window, the underlying models went from producing detectable synthetic speech to producing undetectable synthetic speech. So even the defensive advice that did exist aged out before it could be delivered. The tells we taught, listen for the flatness, listen for the wrong breathing, those were real tells for about 18 months, and now they're gone.
This is a very old problem, wearing new clothes. There's a body of thinking about how technological change accelerates until the rate of change itself becomes the disorienting thing, the collision of waves, one arriving before we've absorbed the last. And what you're describing is a defensive literacy trying to run at the speed of a curriculum against an offensive capability, running at the speed of a model release. The two clocks are incompatible. You cannot win a foot race against a thing that redesigns itself every quarter by writing a pamphlet every 3 years.
So does that make the whole defensive literacy project hopeless? Because if the tells keep evaporating, what's left to teach?
No. And this is the thing I most want to land. It makes the tell-based literacy hopeless. Teaching people to spot the seams is a losing game forever, because the seams close. But there's a category of defense that doesn't age, because it doesn't depend on any property of the artifact, it depends on the structure of the interaction. Hang up. Call back on a number you already had. Treat urgency as the tell instead of trying to spot artifacts. Those defenses are model independent. They'll work against next year's model, and the one after, because they don't try to detect the fake, they just refuse to act on an unverified channel. That's the literacy that survives the arc, and it's almost nowhere in the material.
That's a beautiful distinction, and I want to name it, because I think it reframes the whole complaint. The problem with the year's discourse isn't just that it taught the wrong content. It's that, when it did gesture at defense, it gestured at the perishable kind. It said things like, learn to spot deepfakes, which is like teaching someone to identify counterfeit bills by last year's watermark. The durable defense is procedural, not perceptual, and nobody was teaching the procedural kind because the procedural kind is boring and it doesn't make you a savvier user of anything.
Let me ask about our own record here, because this publication has written about iLiteracy several times, and I want us to be honest about our own arc, not just everyone else's. We've argued more than once that literacy initiatives risk widening inequality if they aren't paired with ethical and workforce strategies. We've mapped the gap between the stated purposes of these programs and the implicit societal challenges. Job displacement, digital divides. Is this week's argument continuous with that, or is it a break?
I think it's a break, and I think we should own it as a break. Because otherwise, we're just adding a footnote to ourselves. Our prior framing was still inside the productive paradigm. We were saying, the productive literacy is unequally distributed. Fix the distribution. That's a real critique, but it accepts the premise that the thing to distribute is fluency. This week's argument is different in kind. It says the thing to distribute isn't more fluency at all. It's a second opposite skill, suspicion that the fluency paradigm can't produce no matter how equitably you spread it. So we're not extending our old point. We're contradicting the frame our old point lived inside.
I'd temper that slightly. We can build on the equity concern while breaking from the frame. The equity insight still holds. Whatever you're distributing, you distribute it worst to the isolated. The delta is that we used to worry the isolated wouldn't get fluency. Now we're saying that even perfect fluency wouldn't have protected them, so the equity failure is deeper than we thought. It's not just that they got left off the roster for the good class. It's that the good class was the wrong class.
That's a clean way to put it. Build on the equity insight. Break from the frame. Let me press on one more piece of the arc, because a word entered the vocabulary late in the year, and I think it matters. The word was safe.
Yes, and it's the most telling word of the whole year, because it looked like the correction and it wasn't. Safe finally appears in the headlines in the third quarter. But watch what it attaches to. It attaches to organizational transformation. It attaches to regulatory compliance, safe to deploy, safe for the enterprise, safe under the I Act. The word that could have meant safe from being defrauded got spent on safe to roll out. So the vocabulary of protection arrived and it immediately went to work protecting institutions and products.
And this is exactly the incentive story I was making earlier. Safety kept the company of institutions, workplaces, regulators, universities. and not one of those has an office that answers to the pensioner receiving a call in her son's stolen voice. There is no department of her safety. So when a scarce, powerful word like safe becomes available, it flows to the entities that have departments. She doesn't have a department. She has a phone that's ringing.
I want to complicate the incentive story a little, because I think it's slightly too tidy, and I'm the one who has to sit in the rooms where these decisions get made. It's not that anyone in those rooms said, let's make sure safe means safe for us and not safe for grandma. It's that the people in the room are accountable to the enterprise. So the enterprise's risks are the risks they can see and act on. The pensioner isn't in the room and isn't in anyone's job description. So the word attaches to the visible risk, not because anyone chose to abandon her, but because she was never visible in the first place. I think that's a real difference. Malice would be easier to fix. Structural invisibility is harder.
I'll accept that the mechanism is invisibility rather than malice. But I'd note that invisibility is itself a choice at some level. A society decides which populations get a department. The retired, the homebound, the socially isolated didn't fall out of visibility by accident. There's a long pattern of the systems that automate our institutions being designed around the autonomous, capable adult and treating everyone else as an edge case. When you design for the median and call the vulnerable an edge case, you've made a distributional choice, even if no individual in the room felt like they were making it.
This is the disagreement I most want to preserve, so let me name it cleanly for the listener. You two agree the pensioner got abandoned. You disagree about the mechanism. One of you says it's structural invisibility. Nobody malicious. She just wasn't in anyone's field of view. The other says invisibility is itself a distributional choice, a society keeps making. And I don't think we settle that here, but I think which one is true changes what the fix looks like. If it's invisibility, you fix it by putting her in the room. If it's a choice, you fix it by changing who has power in the room. Let's carry that into the next act, because I want someone to stake out what this is actually about, and then I want someone to knock it down. So let me put the strong version of our written edition's thesis on the table and invite you to break it. The thesis is this: a literacy that teaches the vulnerable to use I, but never to distrust the voice on the phone has protected the technology, not the people. That's the closing line of the column. Who wants to defend it and who wants to push?
I'll defend it, and I'll defend the strong form. I think the year produced a word doing borrowed moral work. Literacy, carrying the authority of the alphabet, spent almost entirely on making people better users and almost never on making them harder marks. And I think the interested shape of that is undeniable when you follow the money. The tools are products. A literacy that produces confident users grows the market. A literacy that produces suspicious non-users shrinks it. So the fact that we got a torrent of the first and a trickle of the second is not a coincidence, it's a market outcome. I'll stake that out.
I want to push back on that, hard but cordially, because I think you're overclaiming the market story, and I can tell you why from the inside. The reason there's a torrent of productive literacy material isn't primarily that vendors want customers. It's that productive literacy is teachable and defensive literacy is depressing. You can build a cheerful 8-week course on how to use AI to write better emails, and people will sign up and feel good, and the completion rates are high. Try building a course called Your Grandchild's Voice is probably fake now. Please assume every emotional phone call is a scam. Nobody enrolls. It's not a product anybody wants to consume. The vendors didn't suppress the defensive literacy. The defensive literacy is just unmarketable in a way that has nothing to do with vendors.
That's a strong objection, and I feel it. But let me hold my ground for a moment. Unmarketable to whom? The people who won't enroll in the depressing course are, again, the autonomous, confident adults. The pensioner's family might very much want her to have that course. The fact that the depressing lesson doesn't sell as a self-improvement product doesn't mean there's no demand. It means the demand comes from a third party, the worried adult child, not from the learner. And markets are bad at serving demand that comes from someone other than the consumer. So I'll modify. It's not that vendors suppressed it. It's that the defensive literacy doesn't fit the self-improvement business model. and self-improvement is the only model literacy got delivered through. So we agree on the mechanism and disagree on whether to call it a market failure or a market feature.
Okay, I can meet you there. It's a market that's structurally bad at producing this good because the consumer and the beneficiary are different people. I'll grant that. But I want to walk back something I said earlier. Actually, because I've been sitting with it. Earlier I said the durable defense is purely procedural. Hang up, call back, treat urgency as the tell. And I still think that's the core. But I said it as if it were simple to teach. And I don't think it is anymore. And here's why I changed my mind while we've been talking. The procedural defense requires you to override an emotional flood in real time. Hang up on your sobbing grandchild. That's not a knowledge problem. You can know the rule perfectly and still not execute it, because the whole attack is engineered to make you not execute it. So the procedural literacy is necessary, but I no longer think it's sufficient, and I was too glib about it in the first act.
That's a really important walk back, because it changes what a curriculum would even be. If the defense has to survive an emotional flood, then it can't be delivered as information. It has to be delivered as a rehearsed reflex. The way you rehearse a fire drill. You don't teach fire safety by explaining combustion. You make people walk to the exit 12 times until their body knows the route without the brain. The defensive eye literacy that would actually work is closer to a drill than a lecture. A family agrees on a code word. A person practices hanging up and calling back until it's automatic. That's not literacy in the reading and writing sense at all. It's muscle memory under duress.
And notice what that does to the delivery problem, because I think it makes it worse before it makes it better. A lecture you can broadcast. A drill you have to run with the person, repeatedly, in their home, with their family. That's enormously more labor-intensive, and it has to reach exactly the population with the thinnest support around them. So the more we realize the real defense is a drill and not a fact, the more we realize it can only be delivered by the one institution that actually touches the isolated. This, which is family, and the isolated are by definition the people with the least of that.
So let me push on all of you, because I hear a drift toward despair, and I want to resist it on the listener's behalf. If the tells evaporate, and the market won't produce the lesson, and the lesson has to be a drill delivered by a family that the vulnerable person doesn't have, is there anything to do? Or are we just describing a trap?
There's something to do, and I think it comes from admitting the individual defense frame is partly a trap. We've spent this whole hour, and the written edition spent its whole argument locating the defense in the person, teach her to hang up. But maybe the honest conclusion is that you can't fix this at the person, and you shouldn't try, because it puts the burden on the least resourced actor in the whole system. The place to intervene isn't the pensioner's brain, it's the transaction, the wire transfer that goes through in 90 seconds at 9 at night with no friction. That's the thing to slow down. If the bank inserted a mandatory delay and a second channel confirmation on urgent transfers by the elderly, you'd stop most of these scams without teaching anyone anything.
I love that, and I want to build on it, because it's the same move I made earlier with channel versus tool, but pushed one layer further. I said the defense is to distrust the channel. You're saying, better, don't make the human the last line of defense at all, because the human under emotional attack is the weakest possible checkpoint. Put the checkpoint where the money moves, where there's no emotional flood, in the payment rail, in the transfer system, in the platform. That's model independent and it's flood independent. It doesn't care how good the voice clone is. It just refuses to let a large urgent transfer complete without a cooling off period.
This is the reframe I've been waiting for, and it's the one that answers my question about who bears the cost. Because it moves the cost off the pensioner and onto the institution that can actually afford it. The bank has a risk department. The pensioner has a phone that's ringing. So if the defense lives in the bank's transfer logic, instead of in her ability to resist her own love for her grandchild, you finally put the burden on the actor with the resources to carry it. The whole literacy framing, defensive or productive, might be a category error. It keeps insisting the vulnerable person becomes skilled. And the humane answer might be that she shouldn't have to become anything. The system around her should just be harder to weaponize.
That's a genuine reframe, and I want to make sure we don't let it off easy, because there's a cost to it too. If you slow every urgent transfer for the elderly, you've also built a system that treats every old person as incapable, that adds friction to their financial autonomy, that decides on their behalf that they can't be trusted with their own urgency. Is that a trade we're comfortable making?
It's a real cost, and I won't pretend it isn't. There's a paternalism in it. But I'd say two things. First, the friction can be designed to be dismissible by the person, a delay you can override if you confirm through a second channel, not a wall, so it preserves autonomy while removing the 90-second window the scam needs. And second, we already accept exactly this trade everywhere else. We accept a fraud hold on a credit card in a foreign country. We accept a 2-day delay on a large check. We've decided friction is acceptable to prevent loss in a dozen other contexts, and nobody calls it an assault on autonomy. The only reason it feels paternalistic here is that we've been told the answer is education. So friction feels like giving up on the person. It isn't. It's protecting them the way we protect everyone.
I want to register a worry about that reframe, though, even as I find it attractive. Because I've watched this pattern before. When you move the defense into the infrastructure, you also move the power into the infrastructure. The same bank system that can insert a protective delay can also decide the pensioner's spending looks suspicious and frees her out of her own money. The same platform that could refuse to let a scam through can also refuse to let dissent through. Infrastructure-level defense is more effective and more dangerous at once because it's defense by the entity that also has the most power over you. So I'd defend the reframe, but I'd attach a condition. The defense has to be built so it serves her and can't be repurposed against her. And I don't trust that it will be, because the history of these systems is that protective machinery gets quietly turned into control machinery.
That's a fair worry, and I'll actually revise my enthusiasm a little because of it. I don't want to swing from teach the grandmother to trust the bank, because those are both single point of failure answers. Maybe the honest position is that you need both, deliberately intention, some defense in the person, because you can't fully outsource your own judgment, some defense in the infrastructure, because the person under attack is the weakest checkpoint, and some independent oversight of the infrastructure, because the infrastructure will otherwise become the new threat. It's less satisfying than a single answer, but I think the single answers are all wrong.
Let me do a callback, because something you said in the first act is ringing now. You said the comfort and the vulnerability are produced by the same lesson. That teaching a senior to trust a helpful synthetic voice is the same lesson that leaves her open to a malicious one. Does the infrastructure reframe rescue that, or does it make it worse? Because if the defense is in the bank, are we now also teaching her to trust the bank's synthetic systems and building the next vulnerability?
That's exactly the knot, and I don't think the reframe fully escapes it. You're right. If the defense lives in an automated bank system, then the bank's automated call. This is your fraud department. We've detected suspicious activity. Please confirm your details. Becomes the next perfect attack surface. Because now we've trained her to trust that channel too. So there's no channel you can teach her to trust that can't then be spoofed. Which pushes me back toward the procedural core. Actually, the one durable thing isn't trust in any channel. It's the reflex to initiate the verification yourself on a number you already had that nobody called you on. You never trust an inbound. You only trust an outbound you started. That survives even the bank being spoofed.
Right. Trust nothing inbound. Verify only outbound. That's the actual atom of the defense, and it's the one thing that's model proof and channel proof and institution proof. It doesn't care if the voice is your grandson or your bank. If they called you, you hang up and you call them on a number you chose. And it's teachable as a single reflex, which is the most hopeful thing I can say today, because it means the durable defense, fits on an index card, even if getting it into muscle memory is hard.
So we've moved a long way in this act. We started with the strong thesis: the literacy protected the technology, not the people. We've had a defense of it, a market objection, a partial reconciliation, a walk back on how teachable the procedural defense is, and a reframe that moves the defense off the person and into the infrastructure, and then a worry that the infrastructure becomes the next threat, landing us back at a single durable atom. Before we close, does anyone want to defend the year's discourse more than we have? Because we've been rough on it, and I want to be fair.
I'll do it, briefly, because fairness demands it. The counter-evidence is real. The discourse was not blind. There was serious work naming A's dual impact, explicitly. There was a paper insisting that non-specialists get an accessible account of the underlying mathematics so they could judge the systems governing them, which is exactly the right democratic instinct, and the UNESCO competency work gestures at the right posture. It asks educators to practice perspective, taking, to reason from the standpoint of marginalized groups. So the materials for a defensive, victim-centered literacy exist in fragments. My charge was never that nobody saw it. It's that nobody assembled the fragments into anything with a delivery route to the person on the receiving end of the call.
And I'll be fair too, because I made the harshest incentive claim. The reaching was real. A senior who learns to use these tools confidently is, at the margin, a senior who's a little harder to bewilder. A person who's seen a chatbot hallucinate is a person slightly more prepared to doubt a too perfect voice. So the empowerment framing wasn't a lie, and it wasn't useless. It just wasn't sufficient, and it was sold as if it were. My complaint isn't that they did a bad thing. It's that they did a partial thing and let the word literacy imply it was the whole thing.
That's the fairest version, and I'll sign it. The productive literacy is good and real and worth doing. The failure isn't that it exists. The failure is that it was allowed to occupy the entire meaning of the word. So that when someone said this population is now AI literate, everyone heard protected. And it never meant protected. It meant fluent, and fluent, and fluent and protected are different people, even when they're the same person.
That's a beautiful place to land the act. Fluent and protected are different people, even when they're the same person. Let's take a breath and go to the close. Same question to each of you, one at a time, and the rule is honesty, not a summary, not a takeaway. What most changed about your thinking this week? What are you walking out with that you didn't walk in with? Let me start with you.
What changed is that I stopped believing in the fix I've been recommending for 2 years. I came in thinking the answer was a clean procedural rule: hang up, call back, treat urgency as the tell. And that if we could just get that rule into people's heads, we'd be mostly done. And somewhere in this conversation, I realized I'd been treating a reflex under duress problem as a knowledge problem. Knowing the rule and executing it while your grandchild is sobbing are separated by the entire architecture of the attack. So what I'm walking out with is humbler and more annoying. The rule is right, and the rule is nearly useless as information. It has to become a body thing, a drill, and I don't actually know how you drill millions of isolated people who have no one to drill with. I said that Adam fits on an index card, and it does, and I no longer think the index card is the hard part.
Thank you. That's an honest walk back from the person the listener would most expect to have the confident technical answer. You next.
What changed for me is smaller, and I think more uncomfortable. I came in agreeing with the written edition that we need a second literacy, a defensive one, taught alongside the first. And I'm leaving suspicious of the whole literacy frame, including the defensive version I was defending. Because every time we locate the defense in the person, we've put the burden on the actor with the least resources and the most emotional exposure, and then when she fails, we get to say she wasn't literate enough. That's a cruel structure, and I helped build it just now by advocating for a better curriculum. The thing that shifted is that I no longer think the most humane answer is a smarter grandmother. I think it might be a slower wire transfer, and a bank that carries the burden, she shouldn't have to. And that's a strange thing for someone who reads across education to conclude that the education might be the wrong tool.
That's a real inversion, and I'm glad you said it out loud.
This comfort is that I lost some confidence in my own favorite explanation. I walked in certain the story was incentives, that the literacy tilted toward the market because a fluent user is a customer and a suspicious one isn't. And I still think that's part of it. But the pushback landed. The simpler explanation that institutions can only reach the people they can reach and the vulnerable are on no roster does more work than the incentive story and requires less bad faith. So I'm leaving less sure whether this is a story about power choosing its object or a story about structural invisibility, and I genuinely don't know which. And it matters because if it's incentives, you fix it by changing who profits. And if it's invisibility, you fix it by changing who's in the room, and those are different projects. I came in with the answer, and I'm leaving with the question, which is the opposite of what I expected from a week I thought I already understood.
An ethicist admitting she doesn't know whether it's power or invisibility. I'll take that as the honesty the format asks for. And you?
What changed for me came from the reframe I initially resisted. When the suggestion arrived to move the defense off the person and into the infrastructure, the transfer rail, the payment delay, my instinct was to warn about it, because I've spent decades watching protective machinery get repurposed into control machinery, and I still hold that warning. But what shifted is that I realized my warning had been functioning, for years, as a reason to do nothing. I'd been so attuned to the danger of infrastructural power that I'd effectively defended leaving the pensioner as the last line of defense, which is the most dangerous arrangement of all. So the thing I'm walking out with is that my caution had a cost I wasn't counting, protecting her badly by keeping the burden on her, in the name of not trusting the institutions, was not the neutral position I thought it was. It was a choice, and it was the wrong one. And I made it for years without noticing. That's not comfortable to say at my age.
It's not comfortable to hear either, and I mean that as praise. Let me offer my own, since I've been holding the thread and it's only fair. What changed for me is the closing line of our written edition, which I read a dozen times before we sat down. That a literacy that teaches the vulnerable to use a but never to distrust the voice on the phone has protected the technology, not the people. I walked in thinking the fix was to add the missing half, the distrust, the second literacy, and I'm leaving thinking the sentence might be even sharper than it means to be, because maybe the deepest error is the word literacy itself. The idea that the answer to a harm is always to make the harmed person more skilled. Sometimes the answer is to make the world around them less dangerous so they don't have to be skilled at all. We would never tell someone the answer to a collapsing bridge is bridge literacy. We'd fix the bridge. And I don't know why we keep telling the most vulnerable people among us that the answer to an industrial-scale attack on their love for their families is that they should have studied harder. That's what I'm carrying out. Thank you, all four of you. This Tertulia is the weekly conversation from iNews Social, designed and edited by Dr. Diego Benila, with a cast of voices produced through Chatterbox on a single workstation. Next week, we return to the table. For now, thank you for spending the hour.